Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Arthropod. This episode was unplanned until last night due to recent events in Ukraine. I wanted to do what we could as a podcast to, you know, so my goodness, this is a lot harder than I thought. The official stance of me and the other co-hosts is that the war in Ukraine is unjustified, and we fully support the Ukrainian people. On that note, I reached out to a Ukrainian entomologist that I know via Twitter, and thought we would just talk today about what's going on in the country, how war has affected entomology in Ukraine, and we'll see how it goes. I am I reached out to him last night at about 11 o'clock, and it is now 9:30 the following morning. So I'm not nearly as prepared for this as I normally would be. Sorry, listeners. This is timely and pressing, so I wanted to get it done. Thank you for listening. And Victor, could you introduce yourself and let's talk about Ukraine.
Thank you, Mikhail. So my name is Viktor Baranov. I'm an entomologist of Ukrainian origin. I live and work in Germany for the last more than 8 years. I still have my family in Ukraine. And before we start, I just want to tell you, stand with Ukraine. This war is absolutely unjustified, aggressive war of imperialistic regime against peaceful country. And there is no other way to talk about it. And, as a scientist, or whatever it was, I study flies and evolution of flies. I look a lot into fossils, trying to understand how flies evolve the way they are. And there are a lot of flies, 250,000 species at least in the modern fauna. And it's a bit of a hassle trying to understand how we got there. So I'm looking at the fossils, looking at the extant flies, trying to solve a puzzle, why there are so many flies and why there is a fly for almost everything, from skating on the surface waves of the ocean to living in the very deepest caves. So that's the short version of it.
And I do want to note here, I've been kicking the idea around of inviting you on to talk about your fly work for a while. Victor had a couple really neat papers on fossil chironomids come out just even in the last few months, one on a Lagerstätten from Montana. And then you co-authored a paper on some flies on a Lagerstätten from Australia. And the photos are amazing, and it's really cool work. And if we don't touch on it more today, I would like to have you on at some point when the world isn't burning down to actually talk about it.
Absolutely. I do love my flies. And, you know, Lagerstätten in Australia in particular, it's amazing work. I have a very humble little place in it. It's by my friends and colleagues, Dr. Matthew McCurry, Dr. Michael Fraser from University of Canberra, and a bunch of amazing scientists working together to present the world this amazing Lagerstätten we excavated on the indigenous lands in New South Wales. But I guess it's warranting talk of its own, and we probably can get Matt to talk about it. So Matt McCurry, curator of fossils in Australian Museum. That's gonna be awesome. But yeah, Ukraine and insects. I'm now gonna share my screen.
For the listeners, obviously you can't see what's going on. We'll try to talk through some of these photos and we'll post them to the show notes afterward.
All right, here we go. So I called my quick and dirty presentation I threw together in 20 minutes between doom scrolling the news feed and trying to stuff my first lunch of last 24 hours into myself, Ukrainian entomology, war and defiance. it would be really disjointed, and it's really a mix of couple of historical events, my personal experience, and highlight of several amazing people who really, well, making Ukrainian entomology an outstanding scene. And I want to tell that, you know, science-wise, Ukraine flies under the radar for many people. It is not widely known nowadays that, for example, the first atom fission was achieved in Kharkiv, a scientific center at the east of Ukraine, or well, at least it was about to be achieved, but the World War II started. But Kapitsa's group in the Physico-Technical Institute before the World War II developed the theoretical framework for the atom fission. Kharkiv is now under siege. Lots of colleagues, Ukrainian scientists there, already enlisted in the territorial defense forces. For American listeners, it's a National Guard analog who are getting limited weapons and vehicles training and gonna defend their homes. So yeah, and there are a lot of major scientific breakthroughs was done in Ukraine. For example, my university, Kharkiv State University of Vasily Karazin, Kharkiv, had three Nobel laureates. One of them, Ilya Mechnikov, got his Nobel Prize for understanding of the cell immunity together with a German colleague, Paul Ehrlich. They had a competent theory of the cell-based and antibody-based immunity, which is now, of course, super relevant for fighting back COVID. And they were bickering for years, and then Nobel Committee understood that actually both gentlemen had the right, and they got a joint Nobel Prize in medicine and physiology. And Ukrainian entomology is also amazing. We have a very storied history going back at least 150 years. We have some of the major collections. So my university is over 150 years old. It was funded in 1837. And it had entomology collection almost from the get-go, 2 years in. And Kyiv Zoological Museum has thousands of holotypes. We have a world-class amber collection coming from the native Rovno Ambers. This territory is now also under Russian troops attack because everything is now under attack. And there was a lot of amazing people who graced Ukrainian entomology with their work, from Nina Boshko, expert on agricultural pests, but she also was a very dedicated worker on tardigrades. And she was working on tardigrades in early 1930s in Soviet Union until she was had to stop because Soviet government was about to prosecute her for being an enemy of the state and an English spy for doing economically unviable research, because that was something that could land you in Gulag in 1930s. And several scientists from my university actually did land it in Gulag because of doing work like studying bird migration, which was deemed to be not necessary for the people's economy. And then after Nina Boshko, we have people like Arnoldi, who started a first hydrobiological station in Eastern Europe. And we have my late CSIS supervisor, Alexander Bartenev, who was absolutely amazing artist and done thousands of watercolors of living beetles and tropical butterflies. I hope they will get a own exhibition one day. There are people like, for example, Lev Shelushko, a famous venture capitalist, you can say almost Elon Musk, of the early 20th century Ukraine, very brash, very self-promoting person, but also a brilliant scientist and brilliant entrepreneur who launched the largest aquarium fishes company in Eastern Europe, competing with suppliers in Germany and France. He built his first heated fish nurseries in Kiev in early 1905, but he also was amazing, absolutely meticulous field entomologist and lepidopterist who traveled the breadth of Eurasia, collecting several hundred thousand butterflies, which are now sitting in Kiev Museum of Zoology of National Academy of Science. When Bolsheviks defeated first Ukrainian independent government of Ukrainian National Republic, UNR, in 1921, Lev Shelushko had to flee to Europe, where he also stayed very competitive and successful aquarium fish entrepreneur in the pre-war years leading to World War II. And then there is, of course, Sergei Yakovlevich Paromonov, famous Ukrainian dipterist turned Australian dipterist, who was one of the managing curators of the CSIRO Australian National Insect Collection in Canberra. I will talk more about him because his life is closely intertwined with World War II, and to me, an example of amazing personal bravery and dedication to craft, but also to humanity, which I think is very inspiring, and we can get something from it today. So I go to the next slide. And I guess I talk a bit about Ukraine because I have a map of physical geographical map of Ukraine on the screen right now. Ukraine is the biggest country located entirely in Europe, which you might not think of it like that every day because it's flying under the radar unless we have a war or a major disaster. But it is 613,000 square kilometers. It's almost twice the size of Germany, and the only bigger country in Europe is the European part of Russia. But it's the largest country located entirely in Europe. It stretches more than 1,000 kilometers south to north and more than 1,200 kilometers east to west. It has two major mountain chains, a Crimean Mountains and Ukrainian Carpathians. And it cuts more or less in half by the Holocene-built valley of the Dnieper River, which is one of the largest rivers in Europe. And these features, large plains, the Dnieper River valley, and mountains are dominating Ukrainian geography, but of course has sea coast, both coasts of Black Sea and Sea of Azov, which is a shallow internal sea adjacent to the Black Sea and connected to it by a very narrow Strait of Kerch, separating occupied Ukrainian Crimea and Russian peninsula of Taman. And Ukraine is mostly having continental climate. It's a part geographically and biologically, large part of Ukraine used to be a part of a great Eurasian steppe. And Ukraine, if you look at it, is biomically divided into the area of steppes at the south, area of the wooden steppes in the middle, dense mixed woodlands at the north, and then there are, of course, two mountain chains, as I mentioned. So it's a pretty diverse country, biology-wise. We have at least 20,000 species of insects recorded, and we have a project UKRBIN, Ukrainian Biological Inventory, which is aiming to ramp up our knowledge. And new discoveries of animals made all the time. So I, in my time, described two new species of tiny little flies called non-biting midges, or Winnebago midges for some North American listeners, or blind midges for Scottish listeners, if we got any.
I think we do.
Sorry?
I think we have some Scottish listeners.
Right, so they are known as quite of a scourge, and I know that there is actually in the Lake Country north of Edinburgh, there is actually a monument to non-biting midges because they are emerging in really pestilential numbers. But it's actually a good thing. The large number of midges emerging is keeping lands around the lakes really fertile and good for the agriculture. And, you know, there are new species of hoverflies being described by my colleague Grigory Popov and Alexander Martinov from a dear colleague from now occupied Donetsk, who is an expert on mayflies, has described several new species of mayflies throughout the last years in Ukraine. So it's quite a biodiverse country. We also got some new species of vertebrates described in the last 10 years, mostly fishes. We got some really big, impressive animals living in the country. We still have bears in the Carpathians and in the Chernobyl region. Chernobyl Radiation Reserve is one of the most, ironically, intact ecosystem in Europe, supporting one of the most highly ecosystemly functioning forests, supporting both European bisons, Przewalski horses, wolves, and even some bears wandering from Russia. That's the only Russian incursions we are happy for in Chernobyl area. Yes, so Ukraine is a biodiverse country with continental climate. We get quite hot and dry summers in the south and the central parts. We get very cold winters. I used to go at school at minus 32 and it still wasn't closed. Unfortunately now, due to the rapidly rising temperature and temperatures in Ukraine, global temperatures in Ukraine are rising faster than in Europe on average. Winters like that are mostly seen of the past.
So well, you've done work with climate change as well, in addition to your fossil work, correct?
Yeah, that's true. I worked for Zenkenberg Research Museum in Frankfurt, and I worked in the Department of River Ecology and Restoration, and we looked at how climate change in central Germany, in the state of Hesse, impacted one tiny little stream called Breitenbach, which was monitored by Max Planck Institute for River Ecology, which is now unfortunately closed since 10 years. For 40 years, they monitored this tiny little stream, sampling aquatic insects every week with special sort of greenhouse traps, which they built over the stream. And we find out pretty horrifically that in comparison to the beginning of the studies in 1969, 81% of biomass of aquatic insects was gone by the time when time series ended in 2010. And average temperature rise, the mean annual temperature of the air in Breitenbach area increased by 1.37 degrees Celsius, which is actually outpacing level of warming in the industrial countries. So, you know, it's a very prominent alarm bell.
Well, that's, I don't mean to diverge too far from Ukraine.
I'm always happy to talk about it. No matter the threat of Russia, I just have to say, no matter how tired we are of COVID and how scared we are of imperialism and rising autocrats, whenever we deal with it to the best of our abilities, we still have climate change to contend with. And, you know, that's actually, that's my central message, which I wanted to tell, which I wanted to stress in the end, but standing up to autocrats, making healthcare and society inclusive and kind for everyone, and fighting climate change are not opposing goals on the different wings of political spectrum. They are must for our sustainable and prosperous development as humans. I blew it. You see, no. Spoiler alert. Must have.
No, that's okay. We'll get we'll come back around and hit it again at the end.
Right. But coming back to Ukraine, I will jump a couple of slides forward. It's pretty disjointed here. When I was a schoolboy, praying mantises were my absolute favorite animals. I read Gerald Darrow. I don't know if you like Darrow.
I'm not familiar.
No, it's a British writer slash naturalist who was really one of the pioneers of wildlife conservation in 1940s, 1970s. And I adored his books. And as a schoolboy in Greece in 1930s, he used to have a lot of praying mantises, and I adored them. But I'm from Chernigiv. That's a ancient provincial town at the Russian border, and actually lots of lands of modern Russia belonged to our principate, and all this, you know, stage and area of Russian army. I actually break away provinces of a principate, of a great Chernigiv principate I hail from, and we don't take lightly to this separatism. Anyhow, it's very north of Ukraine. It's about as far north as Berlin, and I didn't had any praying mantises when I grew up. However, by the time I was 14, first praying mantises, that's been mantis religiosa, common praying mantis, had appeared in my area. I caught one while cleaning the weeds on our market garden plot. And I was absolutely astonished. The weed cleaning stop work for the day was blown up. It was during the summer holiday. You have to understand one thing about Ukrainians. We are a nation of farmers, and everybody has a market garden growing their own potatoes, vegetables. So it was kind of a big deal that a praying mantis has derailed my work activities for the day. But here we were. It was a female. She laid an oateca, and I got some young praying mantises, and I was delighted for the rest of my summer holidays. And into the next spring when the young ones hatched. So actually praying mantises are moving north in Ukraine due to the climate change. And here I have a slide with several prominent, large, impressive insects from Ukraine. I will start with praying mantises because I love them so much. We have 5 or 6 species, depending on whom you ask, in Ukraine. We have mantis religiosa, common praying mantis. We have iris, the Mediterranean praying mantis. We have this little guy, Amelis, over here. There is a tiny mantis sitting on a patch of a lichen in Crimea. And then we have this absolutely astonishing animal called Bolivaria brachyptera. I don't know if it has any vernacular name. It's obviously named after Simon Bolivar, the great freedom fighter of South America.
Yeah.
And which I don't know the story. I just guess he impressed whoever described the Bolivaria with his freedom fighting and, you know, his ideas of Pan-Americanism in 19th century. This Bolivaria on the photo is very dear to me because I photographed it when we were at the Mud Volcanoes, which is a special type of geological feature. It's kind of like a Yellowstone geysers, but they expel in a clay dissolved in the water. And they normally associate with the low-lying oil lenses at the continental shelf crust. And this is in Crimea, which is now obviously occupied. We've been there in 2010 with my wife and my former friends. And we found this Bolivaria and a black widow spider, and we had a lot of fun. And I still fondly remember in this day with a lot of sadness, because I think until Ukraine reassert its control over occupied Crimea, there is no going back there for me, as for so many other people, but I will talk about it. I also have here a very large, chunky lady. This is a female of Hierodula transcaucasica. It's an invasive mantis spraying to us from Mediterranean. They are very large. You have an Arizona mantises in US. They look and behave very similar, very aggressive, very proactive. They might jump on your face and, you know, pierce your nose if they don't like you. Very feisty. And also here I have a Libellulidis, Ascalaph, and all fly. A very nice, beautiful lace wing with a patterned yellow and black wings. It was on the same trip to Crimea in 2011 as I seen this guy flying by me, and I never seen one before. So I made a sprint through the ground squirrel burrow ridden field, trying to overrun this guy who was flying really fast. And finally, I scooped him with my hand net, which I hold, which I held in my hands, and we got this very nice photo, which is, you know, it's also heartbreaking. I'm looking at this insect and I'm thinking that every single area where you can find those now are either occupied by Russian troops or Ukrainian army is taking fights there, because it's all in the south along the Black Sea. So for me, looking at every single photo of insects from my youth and university years from Ukraine is intertwined with so much grief of little tiny things which are lost. You know, now and for the last 8 years, Ukraine is bleeding its defenders. For 8 years, it was every day one or two deaths. Sometimes there were good days when nobody died at the east. And so there was all this horrific human losses, which amounted up until tomorrow to 50,000 civilians and Ukrainian soldiers. And since tomorrow, who knows, there are horrific losses due to the Russian invasion. But besides this horrific human cost, there are also so many little things which we all lost. Like, for me, it's just an ability to see a beautiful insects which are living in my country, but as a part of my country which is occupied. It's not really important, but somehow it's also heartbreaking, and it always makes me think of Crimean Tatars, which are native Muslim nation whose land Crimea is, who were dispossessed and deported by Stalin en masse. Several hundred thousand people were deported, German concentration camp style trains, in several days after Russia retook, or Soviet Union retook Crimea from Germans in 1943. And they haven't been allowed to return. Tens of thousands of them died in exile in Central Asia. Ukrainian government, so when Soviet Union fell apart, these beautiful people were able to return to their land, facing friction with colonists who Soviet Union soon in Crimea. And they were trying to reclaim their ancestral lands with some help from Ukrainian government all over these years. But now Russia occupied the land again, and they are oppressed again. They are ardent supporters of Ukrainian Crimea in their vast majority, and many of them, especially political activists and Muslim clerics who are preaching for peace, but also deoccupation of Crimea and return to democratic Ukraine, are prosecuted and imprisoned, and some even have been killed by Russian secret police. So when I'm looking at these insects, I'm getting into this chain of thought from remembering a very lovely day in my youth to thinking of political activists who have been murdered in the name of imperial ambitions.
Yeah, well, we should note, like, we're having this talk today because of the most recent invasion, but I mean, Russia has been in Crimea for the last 8 years and in Eastern Ukraine after that. Like, this isn't, the escalation is new, but Russia invading Ukraine isn't, even though a lot of Americans don't think about it.
Yeah, I have to stress that Russian-Ukrainian war is going for 8 years now. It started 8 years to a day in February 2014, when Ukrainian Revolution of Dignity led to the cowardly escape of our once president, Mr. Yanukovych, to Russia. And Russia invaded Crimea. And several months after, to our complete shock, our long-term neighbor, whom we thought of as a friend, started actually killing Ukrainians in the East. That was a complete shock. It felt like a hammer blow. I haven't felt like that since spring 2014, when I already was, I immigrated to Germany by then. I immigrated before the war, just looking for opportunities to develop my research career. But I felt very harshly the hammer blow of this betrayal of trust from our neighbors. And yesterday I felt it similarly, but differently, because no trust left by now. It was just, you know, hope that maybe colossal human cost of this war will prevent it. But would you know it?
Before we move on, can I ask about Crimea, specifically the fauna there? You mentioned some of, like, this one mantis is only found in Crimea. You'd only ever seen this owl fly down there. Is the climate in the insect fauna of Crimea, like, very different from the rest of the country?
Yes, it does. So Crimea is this very far outlying peninsula sticking into the Black Sea. And while most of Ukraine in Köppen's climate scale would be like continental or mid-Atlantic at the very best, in Crimea, it's actually Mediterranean, at least for the narrow strip at the southern tip of the peninsula facing into sea. It's a very interesting phenomena. It's in the mountain shadows, and about 3 kilometers inland, you still have Mediterranean climate, and then it's more like contrasting dark, cold, hot continental climate. And this very narrow 3 kilometer strip held them, only Ukrainian species of gecko, 5 out of 6 species of mantises. So none of our mantises are endemic per se, but in Ukraine, most of them are only found in Crimea. So very special fauna. I described several species of endemic flies from there, and there are a whole bunch of endemic aquatic insects, especially stoneflies, living in Crimean mountains. So it is very special. It was an island. In Miocene, it also used to be an island, and it was separated by the wide interior seaway, choke full with whales and all sorts of different cool beasts, which have been preserved in the iron goethite deposits in Crimea. And I can tell a very cool story about those fossils. But yeah, long story short, Crimea is very special. For example, there are no venomous snakes in Crimea except for the isthmus, which connecting Crimea to the mainland Ukraine. The rest of Crimea is populated by several colubrid snakes. One of them, former Elaphis situla, is very rare and only occurs at the very south. So it's very special indeed. Not to mention flora, but I know that it's highly endemic, much more so than fauna, but I cannot talk about it in any qualified way at any length. I have to just say that blooming Crimean mountains in spring are simply heavenly and very beautiful. I photo of a small river in the rural area in Crimea on the screen. The river is called Western Bulganak. That's Western, obviously not, but Bulganak is a Crimean Tatar name, which I trying to use preferably to whatever abomination Russian colonists came up with lately. And in this river, I described a Hydrobuenus cornejevi, a new species for science in 2011, which I described and named after my master advisor, Professor Korneev.
Was that a chironomid?
It is a chironomid, okay. Indeed. So Hydrobaenus is very widely distributed genus of chironomids. It's pretty widely distributed in North America and Eurasia, and it's used to live in the colder regions. So Canada has a bunch of species of very weird looking ones for that. But Hydrobaenus korneevi is more southern dwelling one. But the story behind it, so I collected them in Western Bulganak, Perevalnoye village, and in Simferopol, the administrative capital of Crimea. And the river in Simferopol where I collected them is mostly dry because of the occupation administration mismanagement of water resources. What happened to Western Bulganak, I don't know. And in Perevalnoye, Russians are now having huge military base, and I guess the type locality is now gone. Another way I got robbed of something dear to me, it's could not be compared with people who were dispossessed from their homes to build the said base. But here we go. You know, war is just intertwining with everything somehow. What are you doing? Everything is tainted by it now.
Was that species widespread, like, or was it only found at the type locality and a few other places? I guess, is there a possibility it's gone extinct with the changes with the river and what's going on?
I honestly think that it still should. So we found it at several locations as wide as 50 kilometers apart. I would guess somewhere in Crimean mountains, they still exist. It would be a very nice story to say that it's gone extinct because of the occupation. But the truth is, I cannot know.
You can't go back to check.
I hold in my hope that somewhere in the mountains, in some small river, so the thing to understand about Crimea, it's a desert for the most part, and it was made agriculturally viable by the water supplied through the Northern Crimea Channel from the Dnieper River, which was built by Ukraine in Soviet times. And that's the only thing which made large-scale farming and industrial farming viable in Crimea. Otherwise, farming only was viable around the mountains where the natural water sources existed. And many rivers and many aquatic habitats were actually dependent in the last 60, 70 years on these channel waters. And Ukraine made a hard decision to cut the water off when Crimea was occupied, because we said that we would not supply occupied territory with resources, because according to Geneva Convention, it's a responsibility of the occupying force. So it itself might drove a lot of aquatic species back into the mountains. And mountains do have their groundwater fed rivers, like Salgirka or Uchansu, other rivers. And I hold my hope that somewhere in the mountains, my midges are still living.
So is it a case that when the Dnieper got diverted into Crimea, like all of this new environment opened up for these aquatic insects, and so they migrated from the mountains or came down? And before 60 years ago, that wasn't a habitat they had. So now that it's gone, they've just gone back to like where they came from.
Indeed, with an added benefit of the climate change, because of course the rainfall in Crimea decreased, especially in the last 10 years. So I would say they probably lost more than they gained with opening up of the new habitats in the steppe Crimea. But I think most of the steppe Crimea reverted to the type of aquatic habitat it has before the irrigation. So very hypersaline waters where only a few species of hardy insects and the branchiopod shrimps could live. For listeners who has aquariums, you might know Artemia, and which is a common fish food for raising fish fries, and rearing the young ones. And Shrimps like Artemia are pretty common in this hyper salty habitats, and Crimea has quite a few of the endemic ones, which have been threatened even before the occupation, and I have no clue what's going to them now.
Do you want to talk about some of the Ukrainian entomologists?
Yes, I would. So I will start with a historic narrative. So I want to talk about Serhii Yakovlevich Paramoniv, or his pen name, Sergei Lesnoy, a very, very fascinating scientist and a human. He was born in the city of Kharkiv in 1894, and he died in Canberra, Australia in 1967. And already by the discrepancy of his place of birth and death, you can start guessing that he had an eventful life. He was one of the pioneering paleoentomologists in the former Russian Empire. He started looking at the fossil insects very early, but he was mostly working on the bee flies. So all our listeners in the Northern Hemisphere, especially in UK, you'll start getting the Bombylus, lesser and greater bee flies very soon. They're really cute and cuddly. They are panda bears of the flies. And I like to think that Paramoniv just liked cute animals. I never met him, but I think we would have connected on our love to the cute, fluffy things. He worked as a deputy director of the National Institute of Zoology of Soviet Academy of Science in Kiev when the Second World War came to Ukraine. So that have to be said. Second World War came to Ukraine in two phases. First, when Soviet Union occupied parts of Ukraine, which were parts of Polish Republic in September 1931, when Soviet Union covertly backstepped Poland, which was barely holding back the Hitler troops. And, you know, Soviets and Nazis basically just split the Poland. And so Lviv and surrounding areas of Ukraine have been occupied. But by 1941, love between Soviets and Hitler was lost. And Hitler started his invasion of Soviet Union, which meant war came to the rest of Ukraine. And it came very quickly to the Kiev. Just like was yesterday, an enemy planes came early in the morning at 4 a.m. and started dropping the bombs on the civilian infrastructure. So it felt so close and so deja vu yesterday, but I digress. So by September, Kyiv was abandoned by Soviet troops, and most of the scientific personnel was abandoned as well. Soviet evacuated some prominent physicists and engineers they needed for the war effort. But most of the members of Zoological Institute stayed behind. And the very first remarkable scene which happened with Paramoniv during the occupation is that he actually had saved the part of historical center of the Kiev from destruction. So right before last Soviet detachments abandoned the Kiev, the political police, NKVD, the Stalin's blowhammer, which was a like repressive apparatus and precursor of KGB, rigged for explosion hundreds of residential buildings and historical sites in the center of Kyiv. I have on my screen a portrait of Professor Paramoniv, but also a building, a photo of high-rise in Ginzburg House building blown up by Soviet troops, not Soviet troops, by NKVD police in September of 1949. And it's complete chaos. You can see this beautiful building just lying as a heap of rubble. And the same fate, so you, now I have a new slide where on the top, we have a very poor resolution photo, but that's the best we have, probably made by some German photographer as occupation troops entered the city, of a burning Kyiv, which was wreaked by explosives, and it was obliterated by the Stalin's political police at the cost of lives of many, many civilian Kievans, just to deny the enemy not any sort of valuable military prizes, but simply to leave a scorched earth behind, together with whoever will survive in this scorched earth. But beneath this panorama of Kiev hellscape being blown up by Soviets, you have two beautiful buildings, a yellow Art Nouveau building of Ukrainian Academy of Science in the center of Kiev, and a beautiful National Opera of Kiev. They were among several buildings which Paramonov was able to save. He also saved a number of residential buildings. He spoke very good German. So when he saw German troops entering the city, he decided that for the sake of preserving historical center of Kiev and saving human lives in the rigged residential buildings, he will cooperate with occupiers. And it was in the interests of Nazis to, you know, leave Kiev as intact as they can. So he saw some of the buildings being rigged by NKVD, and he divulged this information to the head of occupying forces, who was pretty impressed by the eloquent Ukrainian who approached him, and he gave him detachment of military engineers who successfully defused the bombs in several buildings, saved probably quite a few people. But spoiler alert, because of this cooperation with enemy early on, Paramonov was immediately labeled as a traitor to the Soviet people by the sleeper agents of NKVD who stayed behind in the city. And that would have a profound, so, you know, this act of humanity, and I would even say heroism, because he was risking a lot approaching Germans too, and he understood that he would have no further life in Soviet Union, and he was not any kind of Nazi sympathizer or collaborant, but he decided that he will sacrifice his future, whatever it might be, to save some of the beautiful buildings in the city he loved, but most importantly, human lives. During the occupation, 1941-1943, German troops, both SS and a regular Wehrmacht troops, conducted a campaign of genocide against Jews and other racial minorities like Sinti and Roma of Kiev. Babin Yar is one of the most horrific sites in the world. It holds bodies of countless victims of totalitarian occupation of Kiev. But during these 2.5 years of occupation, Paramonov, using his eloquence and good knowledge of German, was able, so he was kept as the head of the museum. Germans allowed limited operations. And employees even conducted some limited field work in the summer of 1942 in the outskirts of Kiev. But because of this activity and being sort of labeled as a, you know, a reliable collaborating person by Germans, Paramonov was able to keep his several Jewish technicians on staff until Soviet Union liberated Kiev. And these ladies, I don't know their names, but I know that there was two or three ladies who were Jewish and whom he was able to alter records for, keep them on the staff, and they survived the war, or at least they survived the occupation. In 1943, when Soviet Union was about poised to take Kiev back, Paramonov, knowing that no love was left for him by the very oppressive Stalin's regime, decided to run westwards. He evacuated, Germans made him to loot and evacuate collections to To the west, towards Königsberg, but most of the collections were later recovered by some of the zoologists serving in the Red Army and returned into Kiev in a good order. But Paramonov himself, so the very complicated chain of events, got to UK and then eventually immigrated to Australia, where he lived in relative obscurity between 1947 and his death in 1967, working as a curator in Anik, Syro. There is a beautiful legend going about Paramonov between the colleagues in Syro. We know that it's probably not true, but it's still a beautiful legend, which I would like to share, that he felt very isolated. He didn't speak very good English. He knew very good German and French, but English kind of wasn't an international language of science before World War II. So his English was so-and-so. He was very isolated immigrant. He spent most of his time looking at the flies. And he had a favorite spot in Canberra at the Black Mountain Reserve, where a Telstra tower, a prominent telecommunication tower nowadays, located. And it's a beautiful, beautiful reserve. I would advise any of our Australian listeners who haven't been there, just go and take a walk. Lots of amazing wildlife and great view over Canberra. And so he loved, this part is true, he loved one spot at the Black Mountain Reserve where he always went to catch some flies. And apparently when he haven't turned up for work on Monday, one day, and he was very particular about times when he was attending his workstation, his colleagues become worried, and somebody had a bright idea, ostensibly to go and look at his favorite spot, and ostensibly they find him there with this very sad person who lost his motherland and had to flee the war and persecution. He was reportedly found with a very content, happy face, lying there dead. But it's probably not true, because my supervisor, Professor Korneev, who wrote a book about Paramonov, found a lady who was his caretaker, a medical caretaker in his later years. He likely died at home in his bed. But reportedly, he also died being pretty content. I would say that beside his scientific track record, he done enough of a good humane things to be content in the end. I'm sorry, Michael.
Kind
of too close right now.
The book your advisor wrote about Paramonov, I assume it's in Ukrainian.
It isn't Ukrainian, but, you know, Professor Korneev is extremely eloquent English speaker, and I think he has quite a few podcasts and articles, and I will send links to you in English. I send links to you, which you can put into the podcast notes.
Thank you. I just listening to his story, like, I want to know more. Like, I would read the book if I could. But anything you could provide would be great.
I think Valery had plans to translate it into English. But obviously, now it's all up in the air. Yeah. You know, even more to tell about Paramonov, I mentioned that he had a pen name. And his pen name obviously was not to describe all the dozens and hundreds of species of flies he worked on, but for his archaeological works. There is something called Veles Tables. It's kind of our Ukrainian Dead Sea Scrolls. It's ostensibly a clay tablets holding the records of the earliest Slavic civilizations in the region. They might be fake, but it never was conclusively proven. And Paramonov was obsessed by them. And in his time in Paris, he was working closely with several French archaeologists to develop his system of deciphering these tablets and publishing a lot on the early history of Slavs. He was absolutely obsessed with it. He was very into idea of, you know, Slavic nations not just being the tributaries or outlying provinces of Russian Empire, but being their own ethnoses which developed independently, though in very close, neat connection for hundreds, if not thousands of years. He was very much historical patriot of idea of Ukraine. And so he was publishing it under the pen name because publishing things like that, he was publishing it in Paris, would very quickly ended his career in Soviet Union, because in Soviet Union, it was one big cosmopolitan family of nation where nobody had any identity except for the Soviet communist religion. I have to say here that there is a lot of good things to be found in the ideas of socialism in their pure form, but Soviet Union had nothing in its oppressive machinery that screamed development of this idea for the good of humanity. Parmenov lived in Ukraine in 1930s, obviously. In the 1930s, Stalin's regime orchestrated the genocide of Ukrainians and Tatars in Povozhye region, because there were this strong farming class which still had money from pre-Soviet time, and they were strongly opposing the authoritarian rule. So Stalin, by increased export of grain from Soviet Union, orchestrated an artificial famine which killed at least 3 million people in Soviet Union. We call it Holodomor, from Golod, famine, hunger. And it's a big part of our national identity in Ukraine. It's one of the several atrocities which different totalitarian empires did to us. And Russia has a whole slew of the pocket historians which are busy disproving existence of the Ukrainian famine. Of course. Right, but I digress. So Parmenov, cool dude, astonishing life, very cool flies, amazing scientist, wild story. I think you can make a movie about him. He was,
sounds amazing.
Was really, really cool guy. I'd love to meet him. I met people who worked with him in Cairo. So some graduate students back then are emeriti professors now, and they remembered the quiet Ukrainian. By all accounts, was very nice, but very reserved person. And Professor Korneev done quite a lot of trekking, hunting for different scraps and bits of information to piece together his timeline. Yeah, so that's one amazing Ukrainian entomologist whom I never got to meet. But I also want to talk about two people who were very influential for my life and for whose safety and life I really afraid now. First of them is my one-time advisor and forever mentor, Professor Valery Korneev, head of entomology and deputy director of Institute of Zoology in Kyiv. So here is a picture of Valery taking a picture of me when I visited him first time after defending my PhD in Germany. I remember he was very proud. I gifted him a copy of my doctoral thesis. When I was a really, really dumb bachelor student, I was really excited about science. I know that I want to be a zoologist. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I was working as a benthic technician in hydrobiology lab. Sorry, you can cut this out.
No, please.
Institute where I worked back then is now used as a forward defense position by a territorial guards of Ukraine defending Kyiv, because it's a really high standalone building, which given you a really commanding view of the northward direction from where Russians are coming now. And so I don't know, hope all my colleagues are all right, but I was a benthic technician. I was sorting lots of gut content from fishes, which were studied in the Chernobyl region and Pripyat River. And I was looking a lot at the very macerated remnants of different flies. I was really excited about it because I thought it's cool to do this sort of sleuthing, trying to understand what fish ate. But Korneyev learned from some mutual... I'm very sorry. My battery is running low. I have to go and grab my my charger.
Okay, I'm back. I thought I would use that break to go get more coffee.
I think the computer actually quit in a moment, so I have actually rebooted it.
Oh, okay.
I forgot to plug it. You see how well prepared I am?
No, that's fine. That's the beauty of podcasting. I can edit out the long bit here in the middle and make it seem like nothing happened.
So I was talking about Korneyev. He really spotted back in 2007 that I was doing this work with midges, and he told me, well, you know, chironomids, biting midges is a really difficult group to work on. Almost nothing is known about Ukrainian fauna, and you really should look into it. And then he provided tons of support to me throughout my career. All my recommendation letters, which eventually led me into the PhD in Berlin in 2013, was written by him. He taught me how to draw. He's very prolific illustrator, but also extremely eloquent and very educated gentleman, connoisseur of poetry and Ukrainian theater, and real Ukrainian patriot. He is a world-class expert on the tephritids, so the fruit flies, who are obviously very important agricultural pests, like Ceratitis capitata, Mediterranean fruit fly, but also one of the most beautiful insects out there. And he studied them all over the place, Australia, Costa Rica. He'd been a research fellow in Smithsonian. Amazingly educated person who had a lot of impact on my professional development. I would not be anywhere if he wouldn't take interest in my disorganized activities back then. And it breaks my heart that this amazing person now have to shelter in the subway from the Russian bombs. Several days before, when he realized that large-scale hostilities are likely to break out, he took some of the holotypes. So for non-scientist listeners, holotypes are a type specimens which scientists are using to define what character species has when we describe any new animal. So, you describe how your holotype look. You tell other scientists in your publication where it lays, normally in the museum, and then any person can use this as a reference to make sure that they got exactly the same species. It's kind of like a universal kilo or a universal meter, which are laying in the Paris metric house. That's like an international standard. So he took, and they are very voluble. Holotypes are all existing in a single copy by definition, but there are also supplementary types, slightly less important, called paratypes. So these type specimens of multiple species of insects were carried by Professor Korneyev to Chernivtsi at the west of Ukraine by train. He had a visit to a couple of nice canteens with his wife last week. And then he decided to return to Kyiv because that's his city. And that's where he wanted to face the war, and face the enemy. And now he is sheltering in the subway. And I really hope that he's going to be all right together with everyone else.
I mean, there is a long history of holotypes being destroyed in war and in conflict. I think maybe the one people that aren't scientists might be most familiar with is the destruction of Spinosaurus during World War II, during the bombing of Germany.
Indeed, right here in Munich, in April 1944, Paleontological Museum of the Bayerische Staatsnaturhistorische Sammlung was bombed, firebombed by the large raid of American B-29 superfortresses, which were carrying part of the suppression strategic bombing campaign. And because of the bickering between Professor Strömer, who described the Spinosaur and by all accounts was an upstanding fella, and the Nazi director of museum, holotype was never evacuated to the safe house. And so now all we've got is several fragmental bones from the holotypes, which Strömer was studying, and they were in the other building, and his notes. That's why Spinosaur is such a Saurian puzzle, which we're still trying to, which our vertebrate paleontology colleagues still trying to assemble in very variable ways all these years after. But I have to say that first reconstruction of Spinosaur by Strömer, with all my respect to the man, was not stellar. It was like a very dumb looking iguanodon standing on the two legs with a big dumb sail. Still.
Well, in the protection of types, even in museums, when there's not a war, is important. When I worked as a postdoc for the USDA, our aphid holotypes are in a fireproof safe. None of the rest of the collection is, but if that building were to burn down through an accident or whatever, you know, we lose a million specimens of other things, but the holotypes are safe and protected because of the collection. Those are the most important specimens. They're by definition irreplaceable.
Indeed.
And that's
terrible tragedy that was a burning of Museo Nacional in Rio really yes. made us rethink how we safeguarding our collections in an increasingly unstable world. And for example, Zoological Staatssammlung Munich, ZSM, one of the largest zoological collections in Germany with which I work, was built, initially their current building was built in the 70s to be able to withstand a nuclear blast in the center of Munich, shell Cold War turned hot. And now they are doing some renovation, which is heavily focused also on increasing standards of fire safety by being inspired by terrible tragedy in Museo Nacional.
I just want to like try to point out how important these things are and what we do to the listeners. That's incredible that he would evacuate those types.
That's a scene which we evacuate if we expect war to come.
Do you know how many types he was able to get out? Was it just flies, or was it most of the insects they have?
I think he took out most of the insect types. There was quite a hefty bag on his.
Yeah.
I only had a very brief chat with him.
Okay. And he's still okay. You said he's in the subway.
He was okay today.
Okay.
That's Kiev subway was built after World War II to be a massive civil defense anti-nuclear war shelter. So it's rated well against conventional bombs. We have the deepest subway station in the world, Arsenalne, which is almost 200 meters deep, because it was next to the strategic Western Air Defense Command of Soviet Union and all important gentlemen, which were supposed to try to shut down American nuclear missiles, was sitting there, and they obviously have to be very, very safe. I hope Kyiv Metro, which is just a beautiful, beautiful transit system, will do yet another great service to the lovely people of Kyiv these dark days. I have to say that my own experience with Kyiv subway was mostly hanging on a handlebar 7 a.m. in the morning when I was commuting from my hometown of Chernigov to have my lectures in the university. But it is a lovely public transit. And, you know, I think just like a London subway during the Blitz, it will save a lot of lives these days.
while I was scrolling on Twitter before we talked, there was the photo today that put side by side photos of some British folks in the subway during the Blitz and a photo from yesterday.
Yeah, same energy. Desperation, fear, but also defiance. You know, I always was very, I was admiring of British folks during the Blitz, when for a while only British Empire decided, when you know everyone else was overrun on the continent, and only British Empire was standing up with obviously all the fighters from all the other nations flocking to its cause, from Polish pilots to Free French. But I really was always admiring the spirit of the Blitz. And you can see something similar in Kyiv. I think it's just community coming together to fight a ruthless enemy. It's probably how we humans are wired. I'm not an evolutionary psychologist. Normally when people talking about evolutionary psychology, and they are not evolutionary psychologists or psychological geneticists, they just talking a lot of BS. So I will leave it to experts. But I think it's something very deeply wired in us as a mammals reliant on the group to survive. Right, but yeah, Korneev is hopefully safe for now. And the second person I wanted to talk about is an amazing female scientist, Dr. Talia Matushkina, who really influenced my career. So you have to understand that Ukrainian science system is very, or it used to be very Soviet influenced, with very rigid hierarchies, and it functions very different from Western academia. And I had ambitions to go and see wider world when I was a bachelor student. And one of the very most important things in my career, which were explained to me, is, you know, how the publish or perish system works, why it's potentially very bad, but also how it's supposed to work if I want to try to go abroad. Because Dr. Matushkina done her postdocs in Dresden, and she traveled a lot. And, you know, it stuck with me that unpublished research do not exist. That's what she used to teach us. And also, she taught me the beauty of a well-done microscopic slide of an insect done well, embedded in the proper mountain. It's very strange, people. You know, we entomologists, both Michael and I and all the rest of us, are just spending ungainly amount of times obsessing about how to position genitalia in some toxic chemicals, which will then harden and look kind of like a plant resin. But that's what it is, right? Is that how you feel about your work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my master's work was on mites. And so I mounted, I mean, absolutely thousands of mites. I ended up doing a lot of it in Hoyer's medium, which unfortunately isn't archival, and you're probably aware of it. And then worked on aphids, putting them in balsam for my postdoc. So I've mounted, oh God, thousands of mites in aphids total, and stared at them. And there's a joy to it, though. Like you said, just the precision work and getting it just right, and then having this beautiful specimen at the end.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite views in life, as much as I like natural landscapes, beautiful animals, you know, beautiful buildings, one of biggest joy for me is to look at the well-curated slide collection. And Matushkina really drew the point that as a scientist, you might formulate hypotheses which will later be falsified. And as long as your data were honest and well collected, it's fine. We're all making hypotheses, and you know, we cannot prove anything conclusively in science, only to disprove something, even though philosophically even that questionable. But your hypothesis can be thrown bin and forgotten. Your writing might not be of much interest for colleagues, 50 years down the line. But a well-curated slide placed into the museum collection would be a priceless archival document, which could be used to do science about which we still have no clue, because, you know, now museomics is rising and we are able to extract genome level sequencing from the specimens collected in the time of Linnaeus. And that tells us a lot about climate change, about impact of humans on the environment. So well-curated specimen in the collection is probably the most important legacy that any zoologist or botanist or biodiversity scientist can leave, ultimately. Because, you know, our phylogenies are fecal, taxonomic papers are just unreadable, nobody reads them, even us, unless we have to. Writing them is a pain. But a well-documented specimen will be there.
What did she work on, or what does she work on?
She's very active. She's quite young. She would be a mid-career scientist if she would not started her work very early. She works on the evolution of ovipositor in early insects. So silverfishes and jumping silverfish, how do you call machelonids in English?
Jumping bristletails.
Jumping bristletails, that's right. And dragonflies. So she done quite a lot of work with fossils. She done some work on griffin flies. So gigantic, cool. Meganeura. So, you know, the eagle-sized dragonflies from Carboniferous, or for American listeners, Mississippian and Pennsylvanian of North America. Because even geology doesn't agree well across the pond. We had different things going on around when all the beautiful, beautiful coal was formed. Anyhow, so yes, she is mostly bristletails, jumping bristletails, and dragonfly expert. And she's also really big in the developmental mechanics of the ovipositor and its modification. So not all of you might be aware, but ovipositors are very important in insects, not only to lay eggs, which would be the obvious function, but also hymenopterans, wasps, bees, and the crowd, their sting is a modified ovipositor, which is made to inject the venom for defensive purposes. And, you know, there are a lot of crazy modifications of ovipositors, for example, in locusts and crickets. You can have them in different shapes or forms, and this is just a sight to behold. But the interesting thing about ovipositors, they really got much, much simpler over the evolution of the insects. You might think about it really, you know, in terms of even maybe an aircraft evolution in the last 100 years. We went from the Brother Light Flyer 1, which was all just very complicated mesh of the levers and pitch controls and wires, to the sleek modern aircrafts, which are aerodynamic with no parts sticking out. So insects are also, they like CEOs and tech bros, they go in for the more and more sleek design of their ovipositors as time goes.
Oh, that's a great analogy. I love it.
I also want to stress that that's not how evolution works, though. Things are not necessarily get more sleek or more complicated over time. It's just what is fit for person, purpose, what's getting selected. And it happens so that simpler ovipositors was doing the job just as well, but required less energy and less resources to develop than a really complicated.
Her interest in, I guess, fossils in paleoentomology, is that what got you into fossils, or did you come at that a different route?
I'm afraid, as much as I love Natalia Alexandrovna, I cannot give you credit for that. I might owe her my relative success in publishing peer-reviewed stuff, because I got tutored by really smart people early on into my grad school, or even before, how to publish. But my interest in paleo is just intrinsic. I like dinosaurs, and I never unliked dinosaurs. The thing is, I wanted to be a paleontologist. But while Ukraine has some areas of science, especially connected to the systematics of certain groups of animals or agricultural entomology, really well developed, our paleontology, while really advanced in some areas, was not, the areas where it's advanced are not the really type of paleontology I was interested in. One, it's oil shale reconnaissance using foraminifera, which is a tiny little marine invertebrates, which are kind of related to amoebas, but I hope no protozoologists are listening to that, or I might be eaten alive by Neisseria or some other brain-eating amoeba, anyhow. So foraminifera are really important for understanding climates of the past, but also for looking for oil. And Ukraine had quite a developed paleostratigraphy with these guys, and also quaternary studies. So Ukraine was entirely swept over by a Würm glaciation. So that's the last glaciation and the last Malinkovich glaciation cycle. And we have quite a lot of beasts from Holocene and Pleistocene. So, you know, the times when the ice ages happened, we have lots of mammoths found. We have some woolly rhinos. The most complete woolly rhino in the world was excavated in what is now Lviv region, but was Poland back there, and now is on display in Krakow Museum of Zoology. Really recommend it. Cool stuff. And we have one of the oldest Central European Cro-Magnon or modern type Homo sapiens camps excavated in Mezin, which is again overrun by Russian troops. It's getting unbearable. It's in my home region. I was helping with excavations there. But I was not really interested in Holocene, Pleistocene, or paleostratigraphy. I want cool animals, dinosaurs, stegocephalians, maybe ammonites, I don't know. And except for dinosaurs, and the only dinosaur remnants in Ukraine are coming from Crimea, and those are from a duck-billed dinosaur from Jurassic, and it's incomplete skeleton. It's looked kind of like Edmontosaurus, which you might know from Canada. So pretty standard duck-billed dinosaur, but we have it, so we're in the dinosaur-bearing country club, if just barely. But we have a lot of marine fauna. I myself found quite a bit of Mosasaurus remnants, which listeners from Montana and other parts of the Kansas interior Cretaceous Seaway of US would know, the terrible marine dragon lizards things. And I was interested in these things, but I really haven't found where I can study it. So I went to study biology. And as I told, because of Korneyev, I ended up studying dipterans, because I was very wibbly wobbly. Oh, I really like frogs, and I really like lizards, and I really like snakes and fish. I don't really like mammals, even though I like them, but I don't want to research them. And then I was, for a time, really smitten with immunology. So I could have been one of the greatest undereducated poor immunologists tweeting about COVID now. Because I would have been a very poor immunologist, because it's an extremely complicated field of science, which I'm not really suited for, but I probably would have some hot takes on COVID vaccines, shall I choose to study it. Thankfully, I hadn't. But the thing is, Ukraine don't have much fossil insects. We have some from Carboniferous and Permian in Garajovka formation at the occupied Donbas, because there is a lot of coal, and where is coal, you can find Carboniferous fossils. But we have amber. Ukraine in Eocene between 47 and 33 million years ago was covered by the same huge amber forest spanning the shores of northern and western Europe, and it's deposited part of the huge European amber legacy in our country. It's known as a Rovno amber, albeit it's not only found in Rovno region, but also in Zhytomyr region, and in Belarusia, and...
Is that the same age and forest that is producing Baltic amber that people might be familiar with?
So the thing is, we don't really know what is the age of the Baltic amber, and so we don't know about Rovno amber either. So in paleontology, there are, broadly speaking, two ways of telling how old thing is. So the listeners might be familiar with a radioisotopic dating, like carbon isotope dating, you know. Elements has different weight, and they will equalize with a given speed or rate depending on the radioactivity of the element. And, you know, carbon isotopes are good to study human history and parts of prehistory into the Ice Age. There is a calcium-argon dating where you can date things back up to 400 million years. But the thing is, you only can date certain types of rocks. And normally it's going best with volcanic rocks. So in ideal cases, like in Jho Formation, which is just a beautiful, beautiful volcanic eruption preserved biota from China, where you have a dinosaurs, birds, and insects blanketed with a ash and penza from a volcano, they are between two slabs or two strata of volcanic rock, and it can be dated precisely to a certain spot in Jurassic because you date a rock above and rock beneath, and the layers in stratigraphy are normally layered sequentially, as it was found by Steno, great Danish anatomist and grandfather of geology. And if you have the date of the rock above and rock below, you get your absolute dating, bam. But then many rocks cannot be dated because they are sedimentary and they don't have certain types of chemicals in them. Some sedimentary rocks do, some don't. So for example, Magrath Flats, which you mentioned, it has volcanic slab on the one side, but not on the other. It has volcanic slab below, so we know the maximal age, but we don't know the minimal age because we cannot date the slab above. There is nothing to date. That's one way to approach it. But then things like amber, they're not always in their sediments in situ where they were deposited. Amber is light, and it was redeposited by glaciers and seawaters of Baltic Sea for millions of years. So we have something called, amusingly, zombie taxa, which are things which are supposed to be extinct, but they are popping up in the younger layers. Imagine a T-Rex popping up along the skull of a saber-toothed skull. Well, that would be a gift to the creation people. But it probably would be caused either by cheeky paleontologists with a lot of funds or by some freak geological accident when T-Rex skull got washed away somewhere in American Midwest by the river and then deposited into the cave with the Ice Age animals' bones. Think about it like that. Amber is often present in the case of zombie taxa because it's getting washed away, deposited into the younger layers, and who knows how old it is. So here comes something called relative dating. If I have an insect in famous Green River Formation from early Eocene in US, Colorado, and I know that this insect only lived, as far as I'm concerned, in Green River, I can say, okay, probably these guys are Eocenic and they went extinct later. But if I found an insect, say a hanging fly, there are hanging flies and bitter seeds in Green River and some in Baltic amber. If I found exactly same or similar hanging fly, I say, must be of the same age. and that's called relative dating. So you use not a complicated isotope decay rate machinery, but fossils, which look similar to, and this is called chronostratigraphy, paleochronostratigraphy, and that allows us to date things. So using this method, we know that Baltic amber, and for the same matter, Rhone amber, are Eocene, but there is a time span of about 10 to 12 million years. How old can it be? From 40-something to 33 million years. It could be almost Oligocene, which is the next epoch of the geological time. And actually now there are a lot of evidence popping up from my colleagues in Göttingen, from Alex Schmidt Paleobotany Group, showing that Baltic amber can be from the lowermost Eocene. But coming back to Rhone amber, it's so this forest produced ambers for probably a couple of millions of years. And it's probably haven't produced it exactly simultaneously in what is now Denmark and what is now Ukraine. It's still 1,500 kilometers, different climates back then. Ukrainian forests seem to be a bit cooler, a bit more continental, still containing a lot of subtropic elements, but less than in Baltic amber. And it's probably a couple hundred thousands to couple millions years older, maybe. It's controversial, but it has quite a big difference in what type of insects you found there. So for example, biting midges, ceratopogonids, their faunas are only about 35 to 50% match between Rhone and Baltic amber. And charonomids and ants are even less matching. So it's quite different.
I brought it up because I've heard of Baltic amber. I'm sure people that have heard of amber in the general sense probably know of Baltic and Dominican amber and whatnot. Like, it's one of the big ones that you hear about. I had no idea that that amber was found in Ukraine at all.
It's mined very heavily and in a very barbaric way, I have to say. Some of the listeners might have heard of Burmese amber conundrum. Mm-hmm. It's a very valuable source of scientific knowledge about age of dinosaurs, of tropical forests 100 million years old, but they also come in from Myanmar, where obviously a military junta toppled democratic government, and even before there, the same military Tamtadaf was cracking down on racial minorities. So there is...
In its mind, in really terrible conditions too.
It is. Well, it mined in different conditions, and that's the thing. And some communities really dependent on it. It used to be mined in some places in more ethical ways before junta came to power, but now it's all mute points. Burmese amber, we really should work towards less helicopter in science and less of an impact of scientific resources extraction on local communities. But what I wanted to say here, some of the listeners might know that Burmese amber is an ethical issue. Almost nobody knows that Rhone amber also might be an ethical issue because it's extracted not as much in the terrible conditions for workers, but with a huge environmental cost. It's washed from under the forest floor using the motorized hydro monitors, so basically a pumps which are throwing thousands of liters of water per hour into the soil to wash amber, but they also kill in the forest and you get in a moon landscape. There is a National Geographic paper which we can link here. There are governmental enterprises which are mining it in the sustainable way and recultivating the soil, but there is also a lot of illegal mining. But the reason why you haven't heard about Rhone amber, it's because it's getting bought and repackaged in many countries as Baltic amber, because they are relatively similar. You can tell the difference either by looking at insects, if you're lucky and you have ones of the ones which are different, or by doing infrared spectrography. But optically, they're quite similar. So I can tell Burmese amber from Dominican amber from Baltic-ish European Eocene ambers, but I would not be able to point the finger and say, that's Ukraine, that's Poland.
That's fascinating.
I done quite a lot of work on Ember. I done some work on Burmese Ember, Myanmar Ember, but now I'm trying to understand what would be the best ethical way forward, how to work on it in the future, if at all. I think that in principle, we all should plan somehow to work on Burmese Ember, but we have to find the right way to do it with inclusion of the local researchers. But local researchers are now normally getting shot by a brutally military dictatorship when they are protesting for democracy. So it doesn't seem to be a right time.
Yeah. One of the paleontology journals put a moratorium on papers on Burmese Ember.
Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology. I have to say, full disclosure, I was on a paper, on an open letter, which was opposing the ban. I'm not opposing the ban or moratorium itself. My reason on being on the open letter was, so there was a proposal to ban funding in publication of Burmese Ember, and I basically came in to write, okay, we ban funding. What about early career researchers? We should think what happens to all the PhD students who will be thrown under the bus. You know, PIs could survive it, postdocs like me could survive it. But if we ban it, we should come up with plan B for all vulnerable young researchers. So that was my main rationale. I just wanted more clarity on how the ban should be implemented in the real world. But yes, we can talk about it in the future. But you know, Ukraine had a lot of amber. I had interest in paleontology. I met a person in charge of amber collection and in Kiev, and they started looking into it. And that's how I become mostly paleontologist. But I still do quite a lot of work on extant insects and climate change and marine ecology occasionally.
Well, and all those things are related, paleo environments and extinct insects and climate change today.
Full disclosure, I hold PhD in geography. My PhD was in impact of bioturbation. That's a process when animals or plants are moving soil and liquids in it. And impacting soil chemistry and atmospheric chemistry in different ways. I was studying how the larvae of non-biting midges, whales, are impacting respiration of the lakes and CO2 emission under the climate change. So lakes are breathing, guys and folks, sorry, this is a genderly non-inclusive. So, lakes are breathing because there are a lot of bacteria in the sludge on the bottom, and they all, many of them need oxygen. And larvae burrowing into the bottom sludge, introducing more oxygen, inducing even more demand for oxygen. It's like building more roads. The more roads you build to solve congestion, the more cars will drive, more congestion you get, induced demand 101.
Oh, that's really cool. We're just hinting at so many different topics that I want to pick your brain about.
Feel free to. If I don't get a stroke from reading the news anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, let's bring it back to current events. You know, people are sheltering, and scientists and everybody else are sheltering in place. Cruise missiles are dropping all over the country. I guess, what do you know the state of say various insects collections you worked on? What do you think? I don't know, looking into the future. I'm not sure where I'm trying to go with this. Where do we go from here? What's going to happen? How does this impact the state of entomology in Ukraine?
I might get very green here, so you feel free to cut it. Ukrainian army is doing pretty good against Russian invaders now. And there is a really huge support, and some hundreds of thousands of people are taking weapons and resist, and occupiers were not prepared to. So there is a good chance that Ukraine is gonna beat back Russian conventional forces against all odds somehow.
I have to admit, it seemed like Western thought was that Ukraine was gonna roll over and Russia was going to steamroll them. And I'm pleasantly surprised that that's not happening.
I wonder why Western journalists haven't talked to a Ukrainian soldier. Because everyone who is still in Ukrainian army professionally, they are there for explicit reason to protect their motherland. And not for money, not for trials, you know, people getting horrific PTSDs, they're dealing with their friends being killed, but they still stay to protect Ukraine. And now we have 400,000 combat veterans, another 500,000 of people who recently got non-combat military training from conscription in the last 8 years. Well, this is a million people almost, plus standing army. And they would not roll over. And now civilians are fighting with improvised weapons, with hunting rifles. Ukraine become a great libertarian capital of the world. In last 2 weeks, all the firearms were swept clear and government relaxed requirements for owning a firearm because, well, they won't let people to defend the country. I know that people might get different feeling on civilians getting armed, but you know, it's what French Maquis did when Germans came. It's what Vietnamese people did when they got invaded by colonial powers. That's how it is. But where I was driving with that, conventionally Russia might lose, conceivably. But Russia has a first limited nuclear strike policy in their defensive doctrine. They are going with their hands untied to deploy tactical nukes if they're feeling that they are losing conventional war. And I'm really afraid that either conventional, either tactical nukes or mass bombardment of civilians will be deployed if Ukrainian army will keep being as effective and steadfast as it is now. And, you know, that's bringing us to insect collections. The main insect collections of Ukraine are obviously in Kyiv, in the both National Museum of Natural History, University Museum of Kyiv State University, and Institute of Zoology, Lviv Natural History Museum, Chernivtsi, number of agricultural research collections. There was big important collection in Donetsk, but they are partly abandoned as the occupied territory, partly evacuated by their curators like Grigory Popov, other folks to mainland Ukraine. So I don't know, honestly, you know, whether Ukraine be able somehow against all odds to buckle this onslaught of the occupiers from the east and north. It remains to be seen, but I have all the faith in defenders of Ukraine. But Ukraine was struggling financially. If we win, when we win, when Ukraine will be free and empty of occupying forces again, we're sure to face a economic decline caused by both COVID and the war. And it will, of course, have a negative impact on how collection functioning. But one thing you need to know about Ukrainian scientists, they can build a PCR thermocycler on their kitchen on a budget of $2 and make it work. It's our ingenious, inspired, beautiful people. And I think future is insanely hard, but amazing ingenuity of Ukrainians, perseverance, and hopefulness will carry both the country and entomological research through, if anything could. I'm trying to be hopeful here. It's, you know, it's very dark. My family was sheltering. My family is now permanently living in their cellar. I'm obviously immigrated and sitting here in my nice warm flat in Munich. And I cannot possibly understand how people feel back there. Before talking to you, I talked to my friend. she and her baby, her 4 years old daughter, are sheltered in their cellar, and multiple launch artillery from Russians are exploding nearby within a kilometer from their house. But even they are steadfast. Even my friend telling me how she has an utmost faith in the defenders of Ukraine and in the perseverance. I just wanted to tell that maybe some of the people listening heard false narratives that Ukraine is not a real country. It's kind of a breakaway part of Soviet Union, which just happened to be by accident. But the truth is we have a history of opposing Russian aggression, which is longer than a history of Europeans, or well, it's as long as a history of Europeans in North America, and it's longer than history of certain colonies, which made up the great and beautiful land of the free United States. So if anyone tells you that Ukrainians are a battlefield between Russia and US, don't listen to them. That's our war. US supporting us because it's pretty clear cut. It's a small peaceful nation getting invaded by the neighbor and punching above its weight to just keep staying alive and independent and do its own thing. Because one thing Ukrainians are not taking well is authoritarians. While Moscovites in their nice northern tsardom have tsars, who were just a tyrants ruling with an iron grip, or depending on the strength of the ruler over the subject, Ukraine had hetmans. Hetmans are like strategoi in Greek policies. It's basically a military leader who you can elect as a free citizen, and Ukrainian free citizens voted, males only, of course, and landlords, but still. And warriors. And if you don't like the guy, or with the guy, of course, again, you can boot him up if he is not up to par with his job and just elect a new one. And Russians were always terrified of that. And if you had misfortune listening to the Putin's war declaration, he made a particular remark that our country is in chaos because we got five presidents in 30 years. I found it's pretty normal rate of exchange of the head of the executive branch and the head of state. And I want Ukraine to keep it that way. It's a beautiful, free country. I hope more people will get chance to come and see its beauty when it's open for the world again. I'm telling people to support charities who are buying medicaments and evacuating orphans to Europe. And I don't know if anyone will be comfortable with them. Also to support Ukrainian army, because how I see it, Ukrainian army is not just fighting for Ukraine. It's definitely not fighting for Ukrainian government. You cannot make Ukrainians to fight for government. They are fighting for their country. Ukrainians don't give a dime about the leadership, except in the case of war, when they get behind the leadership just for the sake of chain of command and consistency and efficiency. They are fighting for the free world, for all of the people of goodwill who are against autocrats changing borders by force. They're fighting for the Baltic states who understand it very well. And if there are any listeners from the Baltic states, from Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, thank you. Thank you, governments. Thank you for your support. And to Polish people, thank you so much for all you're doing for Ukraine. I learned today that Poland scrapped a veterinary certification for cats and dogs, which refugees are bringing across the border. And as a cat person who has my cat brought from Ukraine to Germany 8 years ago, I know that for some people, leaving a pet behind would be the same as leaving a child. And I'm so grateful for Poland to doing that for us. You know, it's somehow thinking of kids and pets in this situation. It's really breaking. Yesterday, a tiny island at the coast of the Black Sea of Odessa called Zmini or Snake Island, which is Ukraine's own only high sea continental shelf island, got attacked by Russians. It's a bird preserve with a really unique colonies of the seabirds, one of the kind in the Black Sea, which are probably now gone because of the Russian military attack. But more importantly, it was an outpost for certain amazingly brave border guards. They got approached by two warships, one of which is a Russian flagship heavy cruiser Moscow, which Russians arrogantly call in aircraft killers. But it definitely packs much more firepower than certain Ukrainian guys with handguns. And they approached the island and they told them to Ukrainian garrison to surrender or be fired upon. They told, I am a Russian warship, surrender or be fired upon. And you can go find this video. It's amazing, even if it's amazingly sad. Ukrainian border guards replied, Russian warship, go f*** yourself. That's a sheer middle finger energy which held Ukraine together for 30 years, and I really hope it will hold it through, because Ukrainian Cossacks fought against Russian Empire. Ukrainians in the Austro-Hungarian army fought against Russian Empire. Ukrainians went as partisans who were fighting both Germans and Soviets during the World War II. And one thing people don't know, that actually Putin telling you that Ukraine never had an official statehood, that's complete BS. Between 1919 and 1921, there was a united country, Ukrainian National Republic, which was formed by the merging of Western Ukrainian National Republic and Ukrainian National Republic. It existed for 2 years. It fought Bolsheviks bravely. It was toppled by a political machinations of Bolsheviks and self-serving politicians within the government. But in the region where I'm from, Chernigiv region, which you might hear in the news now about the fighting, there is a small rail station called Kruty. And it was absolutely strategic because it was the only rail line coming from Bolshevik Russia to Kiev. So Bolshevik army have to head it to transport the troops by trains in 1921. And when Ukrainian government in the winter 1921 looked at the options, who can defend it? There was no one. All the troops were engaged. There was no one to pull back, no reserves, all men's on deck, except for several hundred military cadets in the Command Academy in Kiev. Between 18 and 21 years, the head of state told them that he cannot order them. They're too young and he don't have guts to send all these young men to die. And he asked, would anyone volunteer, anyone at all? And majority of them volunteered. They 200 people took on Bolsheviks military corps of over 10,000 people with artillery and armored trains, commanded by Lev Trotsky, the firebrand of revolution. And most of them were killed. And now there is a small monument standing there to the last defenders of Ukraine. I hope Ukraine will never have last defenders ever again. I'm sorry. You know, in school, we used to learn poetry from the classic Ukrainian poets, foremost Taras Shevchenko, who is known as a bard of Ukraine. And he was a vocal opponent of Tsar regimes in the Russian Empire. He was imprisoned for decades in very harsh conditions in Central Asia, what is now Kazakhstan. He got released and returned to Ukraine by the efforts of his friends, poets and painters who had an ear of him. Next emperor, which came after the one who imprisoned Shevchenko, died. And his most famous piece of poetry called A Will, you know, like the last will of a person. And I grew up in a country where I thought I will never see a war, that war is a scene from the past. So the lines like, remember me and then rise, break your chains and wash your motherland with the blood of the invaders. That's a rough translation. I'm sure some amazing Ukrainian translators done it justice, but that's the gist. So remember me and then rise up. If you volume my memory and memory of all who died for Ukraine, I thought, well, yeah, it's just a school poetry. It's boring. And there are a lot of poets and authors like that. Ivan Bagrany, who died in the Soviet concentration camp, or Vasil Stus, who was imprisoned and died in the Soviet psychiatric institution already in the 80s, so the ostensibly more civilized part of the Soviet history, when they wasn't shooting people outright, just locking them up in the prosecutional psychiatric institutions. I thought, well, it's just, you know, bunch of the boring reading from school. You all got it, right? Everybody went to school and teacher was telling us, well, that's a really important piece. You have to understand it. Whether it's a Kill a Mockingbird, Shakespeare, I don't know, you name it, right? But now I understand it's not a boring school scene. It's just our cyclic bloody history yelling to us, telling, break the cycle, make it stop. So I really want to tell that I don't want a single soldier or civilian to die, not even occupiers. I want them to just all fuck off to their houses, but it's impossible. I especially don't want to brave and beautiful people who chose to defend Ukraine to die, and you know, my father can be mobilized now. That being said, there are so many people volunteering that probably nobody will be mobilized against their will. I just want this will of history to be broken. I want to see Russia happy and prosperous country. I have relatives in Russia. Most of Ukrainian people do. I don't want them to live in squalor in autocratic country, which has an amazing developmental potential to be a world powerhouse for science and culture and international cooperation and be a force for good. But instead, it's just being this dark empire. It's really comical, right? It's in a way, morally, at its core, it's not George R.R. Martin. It's a simplistic story. But sometimes human conflicts are getting really simplistic. If you're a French Maquis or a Belgian partisan who is running to save several Jewish people from the train to the extermination camp, it's a really simplistic conflict. There is no gray areas there. Here is the hero, here are the victims, and here are the perpetrators. There is no gray area. Some human conflicts are complicated, and Russians, every single Russian is a human with their human nature and their conflicts. And, you know, people who are killing Ukrainians now, they got to this point through the combination of socioeconomic conditions, exploitation, state propaganda, and in principle, I feel sorry for them. And I would not want any of them to die. But there is no other way to save this beautiful, crazy, chaotic, free country, which is Ukraine, except for resist.
I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up.
I think so. I can rant for hours, but I also would be breaking into tears every so often.
I really want to thank you for coming on and talking to me today. I know we threw this together kind of at the last minute, and neither of us really knew how this was going to go coming into it. I learned much, much more than I expected, and I am really impressed with, beyond your entomology exploits, your grasp of history and how it all fits together. I got much more than I bargained for when I asked you. This is amazing.
Being from Ukraine is really give you a grasp on history. Just a couple of sentences more to America.
Sure.
I heard a lot of BS from some really high-spirited people in Europe about how we in Europe are also artsy-fartsy and speak so many languages and so worldly, and Americans so limited, and oh my God, we are so developed here. And I really hate this stance, because we in Europe had 70 years of peace because some American boys back in Kansas or Texas or Oklahoma decided to go over the boards, over the edge in Normandy, and in North Africa, and in Sicily, and in the Hürtgen forests, and fought in Bavaria. And I really just want to thank all the American vets who took the line wherever they took it.
I thank you from all of America, I suppose. I know where I stand on sending assistance to Ukraine. I hope that the political leadership can step up and help.
American anti-tank weapons are really helping. If it would be more of them, I know if any of the listeners know how to contact the representative, I don't know how it works. You know, if anyone has an ear of a senator or a person who has an ear of a senator, just let him or she knows that what you America did for Ukraine is great, but much more can be done. And peaceful and stable Europe is an interest of all of the world, including America, including economic interests, ultimately. So it's also about money, not only about moral opposition to evil in the end.
I mean, it should be about that. It often isn't, but it should be.
I understand that sanctions cutting into the pockets of the average person is hard, and everything is so hard. And I am, as an academic, more sheltered than many other people from effects of economic downturn. I just want to say that resurgent Russia is not good for anyone.
Yeah.
Peaceful and prosperous Russia is good for everyone. Maybe we get there someday. I really wish Russia will become that once.
I hope we can get there. So
thanks a lot, Michael. It was a treat to speak to you. I don't get to speak to many people now. Well, but tomorrow my graduate students will come and take me to the zoo, I guess.
Well, that's something at least. We, and I know I speak for John and Jody because I talked to them before I got on. We're hoping the best for Ukraine. I hope that this ends quickly and that you can throw the Russians out without too much loss of life and too much more loss of infrastructure. I hope that we can speak again sometime in the future about your actual research and its happier times.
I would absolutely I normally love to speak about my research.
Everybody does, usually.
Yes. It was actually nice to speak about dating of fossils because it really made me to forget for a moment about the war.
Thank you again for coming on. If people want to follow you on social media, can they do so? Do you want them to?
I'm only on Twitter. I'm fine with people following me. Maybe they can learn something fun about insects or about Ukraine. I don't know. I'm now mostly talking about conditions of my parents' cellar and how is cat doing. But I used to post stuff about fossils and cycling and transitions to better cities with less cars.
What is your Twitter?
So my Twitter is Swarm of Sorts, because that's how my head feels most of the time. But you have my Twitter, don't you?
I do. I'll link it in the show notes.
And my Twitter also, I believe, holds a link to my personal website, where some sections are getting updated regularly and some just having crickets and some spider webs in them. Approach with caution.
If you want to follow the show, we're on...
I will.
We're on Twitter, at @Arthro_podshow. If you want to check out the website for show notes, after Victor sends me some photos, we're going to post them on there and post some links. We are arthro-pod.blogspot.com. And you can follow me personally on Twitter as well. I'm @mscavarla36.